you. You over there. Yeah, come here. It'll be just a minute. I see you going into the Nighthawk's Cafe. Not a bad way to spend an evening if you like movies, coffee, pie. Yeah, don't worry about it, the pie is conceptual. A lot of crazy rumors about that place. One time I heard it was an organic being feeding some giant subterranean monster. But I'll tell you this much is true. Sometimes, if you stay after, the party keeps going. For example, I have it on good authority that if you stay after tonight's exclusive episode, the one and only Oscar Czar, Cameron Maris, is gonna stop by. Might be worth staying after the episode, see what he has to say. Stay tuned.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get the Texans.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Future's so bright, we have to wear shades. 3, 2, 1.
Do you think this movie would have benefited more from a theatrical release rather than just being released directly to streaming?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the strong historical performance of urban fantasy, you know, like The Last Witch Hunter, say.
Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Oh, yeah, 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 that was good stuff there. That was clearly not Harry Dresden. But it was more like Harry Dresden than the Harry Dresden in that Dresden Files show. I think we could get a whole episode of, like, why doesn't this genre ever stick to the wall? There's so many books of that. There's so many urban fantasy novel series and stuff. My personal hope that one will get made into a movie is Sandman Slim, the Richard Codrey series. Very interesting kind of anti-heroic and film buff. Day job is at a trans-dimensional video store that has movies that were never made. I believe some specific name checks include the unexpurgated version of Metropolis and the Jarodowsky Dune called out in it specifically as being things he has. He gets obscure film references in there. For something as pulpy as the series is.
I'm going to have to check these out.
They're also L.A. landmark and tiki culture centric, so they're basically just like novels for Trevor.
And if we're going to do that, probably give a shout out to C. Robert Cargill. Most recently is known for writing Doctor Strange. He also wrote the two Sinister films, but he's an author as well. And he's got two urban fantasies set in Austin. Dreams and Shadows is the first book, and Queen of the Dark Things is the second one. So check those out.
That second one is about my ex, finger guns. That's not true. All my exes are sweet and deserve better.
All of my exes live in Texas.
Well, that explains your residence in Tennessee. Foreshadowing.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Nighthawks podcast, the podcast with the two cinema-centric hosts who like to stay up late and talk about movies. And in the conceptual Nighthawks diner with me is my co-host, my always present dear friend, Mr. Matt Foster. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing all right.
All right.
All right, all right, all right.
For today's episode, we decided to go with another current release, but this one was distributed a little differently. This is a direct-to-streaming service release produced by Netflix. Today's movie is Bright, the film starring Will Smith and Joel Edgerton. Matt, you played a lot of Dungeons & Dragons back in, not even back in the day. Do you still play?
Oh, every once in a while, we'll do some Dungeons and Flagons.
You know, we were talking a little bit about this before, but the world of fantasy period, removing urban fantasy from the equation, but just the world of fantasy period is just, it's a very ripe genre. It's got its own tropes that are so tropey, they're overused, and then they're coming back into vogue. We've got human warriors, and we've got orcs who are the embattled and barbaric species. You've got elves and magic, and they usually band together for some kind of quest. It usually starts in a tavern. It's a genre with a lot of tropes that you can play with. Now, on the other side of the coin for Bright, it's a buddy cop movie, which is lined with its own tropes, set forth by Lethal Weapon and Die Hard with a Vengeance, films like this, where you have a pair of mismatched partners going rogue against the department. One of them is a cop on the edge with nothing to lose. You know what I'm talking about. So we have Bright.
Bright in particular vamps hard off Tony Scott. It's very Training Day. It's very End of Watch.
You know, I think it tried to put itself there. I don't think it... Well, hang on. We'll synopsize first. Bright is an amalgam of the two genres. We've got urban fantasy. We've got fantasy that has been brought urban, with emphasis on urban as a demographic group. And it features Will Smith as a surly racist cop and Joel Edgerton as the almost intensely likable and naive orc cop, the first of his kind... the first orc to serve as a peace officer. He's looking to blaze new ground and serve his city and his species. During a bust one night, our two heroes are taking down a terrorist group's safe house. The duo finds the MacGuffin of the movie, which is a magic wand that can only be handled by individuals with a specific birthright. These people are known as Brights. And so they have the wand in hand and run afoul of several groups. We've got a band of dirty cops that are looking to scrub the orc off the roster. There is a literal gang, a street gang of humans that are looking to use the wands for their own purposes. We've got another gang of orcs who are looking to settle a few personal scores and then also get the wand. We've got a special magic-focused branch of the law enforcement agency, kind of a federal bureau of magic affairs type situation. And you've also got a band of terrorist elves who are seeking to resurrect an ancient evil and plan to rule the earth.
Why is there a fairy in the bird feeder again?
Good afternoon, officer. Fairy lives don't matter today. That's it right there. Now take the little homie out LAPD style like you do.
Oh, and you keep doing all your gangster stuff. I'm just trying to sell my house. Don't worry about that.
Everybody's just trying to get along and have a good life. All of the races are different. Just because they're different doesn't mean anybody's better or worse than anybody.
Hey, where's the diversity hire?
I got a dude in my car. I didn't ask for it, but the whole world is watching.
Boy, it's okay. You don't like me.
Man, I'm not out here to be your friend. I need to know if pop off that you got my back.
Can't hide it, Ward. Humans have physical tells.
Like the face.
What's my face?
The human who needs a lot more conjugal love type face.
Do not wink at me like that.
All Westlake units requesting assistance.
3 out of 9, show us en route.
Shouldn't we wait for the cavalry?
We are the cavalry.
What is that?
Hey!
That's a magic wand.
This is like a nuclear weapon that grants wishes.
That's whatever you want. You want to be taller or shorter? You want $10 million?
You're not stealing that wand.
Get out of this neighborhood.
That's just the dark side of me.
They're gonna kill you, then me. And that's when the stupid is gonna start.
I'm not afraid of the dark.
The magic wand. We have to secure it.
I'm already knowing ain't nobody got my back.
We don't teach that at the academy.
No, they do not.
Matt, there is a lot going on in this movie.
Yeah, a lot that's clearly not Shadowrun.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because a friend of mine, I had posted that we were watching this on Facebook, and a friend of mine shot on there, and I told him I was going to steal this, but he likened it to, you know, if you're comparing them to beer, and Shadowrun is, say, a delicious frosty Shinerbach, his comparison was that Bright would be like a six-pack of Schlitz. Drinkable, okay, but not the top shell. You're not going to win any awards with this one. You know what I'm saying?
How I would put it is, if the two things are pots of stew suspected to contain goodies, Shadowrun is the one we know has rich chunks of beef and potatoes at the bottom. All we can see on Bright is some broth, and we just got to skim some off. Because we really, and another person actually in that same conversation said this feels more like a pilot.
Yeah.
It feels more like a TV premiere, like a first episode, than a standalone film. And I think that's fair. Because a lot here is, it's a lot is, they've opted for a media res. You find out when it walks through their eye line how the world is. They artfully imply quite a bit. They do manage to do quite a bit of successful lean exposition, but they introduce a bunch that is that they were clearly planning on making more than one film.
You know, the elephant in the room about this movie is it's the brainchild of Max Landis, who is he's a writer in Hollywood. He's the son of John Landis, famous director who gave us such movies as American Werewolf in London and Animal House, a really well-established director. And Max is his son and kind of came up under his dad, but has gone on to kind of forge his own little niche of celebrity by being kind of a prolific internet troll. And he's also recently been accused of sexual misconduct, like many, many other people in Hollywood. And so we want to get out there right away that we fully acknowledge that Max Landis is kind of a creep. Looking at his body of work, some of it I liked, some of it I didn't. And so I think one of the important conversations to be had, at least just right off the top for very briefly, is, are we able to separate art from artist here? Now, I'm going to tell you, I have a lot of problems with the writing in this film, and I think those are justified and aren't coming from a place where I'm kind of feeling sketchy about the writer. But it's an uncomfortable situation. Are you able to parse that line, Matt? Is that easy for you?
Well, I to tell you the truth, I wasn't terribly clued into it until we got here. I knew that Max Landis has committed what you might call the sin of engagement in the past. Like, he'll get into it with his critics, which are never productive.
No.
There's always a line, but the issue with me is, what did he contribute? Mostly script. Frankly, he was overpaid for this script. I mean, in keeping with your literary friend Joe Esterhaus, he appears to have successfully set off an Esterhaus bidding war for something that was not that good but must have had some heat. Feels to me almost like the people were attached to it first, and then they threw a script together.
This is a huge budget for a Netflix film. I believe it is their biggest investment to date in a film, in producing a film from cradle to release. And the total budget is listed on imdb.com, so take it for what it's worth. But $90 million was the apocryphal budget for this. Max Landis sold the script, allegedly, for $3.5 million. So, yeah, a lot of money going into this.
By reputation, Netflix is very good to work with. And the $90 million here makes me wonder if they're too good to work with, because I don't know that I saw $90 million on the screen. Now, I know the scriptwriter got, I believe, three. And I'm sure Will Smith was,
I don't know, but he does he commands a pretty high price tag these days.
Can't be cheap to get him to slum straight to streaming.
Well, and when it comes to separating from Max Landis, you've got to look at people like Will Smith and Joel Edgerton. Nobody has accused Noémie Rapace of sexual impropriety. And she worked just as hard on this movie as a lot of the other people involved. And so you take the sum total of man hours and work and artistry that goes into a film like this, It is weird to know that in some bizarre way, your click on Netflix is fueling a machine that gave Max Landis $3.5 million. But at the same time, I really like Noomi Rapace. I oftentimes like Will Smith. And so...
Actually, everybody's calling him checked out and surly in this. And I'm like, well, he's supposed to be.
He's supposed to be.
That's the character sketch, you know?
I will say that I think his character was probably a little too rough around the edges. But I don't think that's any fault of Will Smith. I think he was playing the part he was given. And that's where a lot of my complaints about this movie factor in. But just overall, Matt, how did this leave you? I mean, ultimately, what is your takeaway from the film?
I was over the top on it. Like, I liked it more than I didn't like it. The issue with me, right, is to me, I watched it because it is derivative of other things I like.
Mm-hmm.
So am I the guy to ask? Because I'm apparently a sucker for this junk. I read quite a bit of these urban fantasy junk novels. They're my lunch break read of choice, you know, and they're my guiltiest pleasure. I would discuss heroin with strangers before I would discuss the intricacies of the Harry Dresden files, you know. But they're not good generally. In terms of the prose, it's the novel setting, the what if, and I thought it was interesting when I read some open public normie, if you will, criticism of this. A lot of the people did not enjoy the juxtaposition since they didn't seek it out. A lot of people were like, well, why would you take something cool like orcs and just put it in a tiny little cop car and follow it around all day? I get that, but that's also one of those things where it's not for you. Then the other thing, you know, looping back onto the budget, how do we even decide if something's successful on Netflix?
That is a big question, because it's not... for one, Bright is already greenlit for a sequel. That's happening. So it was successful on some level. Also worth mentioning, Max Landis is said to not be attached in that sequel. So that's more good news.
Netflix has 104 million people subscribed to it. I don't know what 104 million times 9 is, but I think it's about 936 million. So Netflix grosses almost $1 billion a month.
Well, that'll do it.
Did I do that wrong? Did I mess that math up?
Because there's...
104 times 9 is 936. That's $936 million. I mean, some of those people must have the $7.99 package, and maybe some of them are in other countries. But geez, that means they just... Even if Bright was a disaster, they just kind of blew January.
Well, and yeah, so that's that's the question, because you can't... Netflix is notorious for not releasing their metrics. You don't know how many people saw what on any given day. It doesn't have a box office number, which is what we usually use to say, oh, Transformers Revenge of the Fallen did very well, expect another sequel. Mad Max Fury Road didn't do as well, so maybe that sequel's on hold now. And so,
or how about Last Jedi is well on pace to be the second most successful movie of all time. Sorry, haters.
Yeah, and so this age-old rubric that we've used for success is no longer in play. And so it makes you wonder. It's really easy to find yourself in a situation where it's like, oh, well, I don't like Kevin Spacey, so the new Kevin Spacey movie I'm not going to pay money to see. Is your curiosity hate watch of Bright aiding Max Landis? Now, I'm going to argue no. I'm going to argue there's so many other artists working on this movie. I was able to pretty easily divorce myself for that, so long as we talked about it, and we have. But yeah, it's a weird time, and it's a weird thing to consider, you know?
It's also the most outrageous allegations against him are still kind of developing.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a little bit of production rubber band. I guess we could kill one on moral grounds, but sometimes we also have to talk about if you should bother watching it, you know? I can't decide. Like, it was pretty...
Well, here's the thing. The movie was directed by David Ayers. David Ayers, we would know from his previous directing turns, as you so presciently put, he directed End of Watch. He also directed Suicide Squad, which we talked about on the show before. He's also written the screenplay for Training Day, The Fast and the Furious, End of Watch, Suicide Squad. So... a lot of the DNA that we see present in this is it's coming from the guy who does stuff like this. Now, Max Landis, on the other hand, has not been shy about promoting this movie. He has compared it to being his Star Wars, and he also said it was very like End of Watch. Now, I think Max Landis missed the mark on both of those comparisons.
The most functional thing in End of Watch was the relationship between the two leads.
Absolutely, yeah.
And as opposed to their almost ironclad relationship, the relationship between the two leads here is very surly. I mean, they barely bond a little by the very end, you know?
Yeah.
We will not be listening to no orcish music.
I believe that you're lacking in love, Ward.
I'm what?
By love, I mean, like, physical.
I don't need no physical love.
Humans have physical tells.
Tells, huh?
Yeah. It's called a face.
Boy, I ain't making no face.
Well, like the face you're making right now.
I ain't making no face right now.
Yeah.
So you know human face, you know him. You got a lot of them.
A lot of them.
Show me the face Orc makes when he just shut the f*** up. Don't say s***. Just drive to work.
And I want to say something good about this movie, because it's not... overall, I'm with you. I'm just over the line. And I think... too often lately, especially amid, we've talked a little bit about toxic fan culture, but we seem to lose that middle ground. People either love a movie or they hate it, and there's no meat in the middle at all. And I think that's unfortunate, because there are a lot of movies that I think are middling and that are worth something on one level, but maybe not another. I think Valerian is a good example of that. We talked a little bit about that on a previous episode, where it's visually stunning. I mean, just a gorgeous film. It's kind of a fun, schlocky sci-fi space opera, but it's also kind of sexist, and it doesn't do everything right, but it does have some value to it. I think Bright has some value. I think Bright has a lot of value to it, to the point where I'm actually curious to see where they go with it. But ultimately, I think one of the best things they did here is the pitch on paper works. I am so dialed into this, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, where this is just, I'm not a particular heavy reader of urban fantasy novels, but this is something that I keyed into as a kid, is, you know, what happens when characters that would look at home in Middle Earth progress by several hundred years, and now we're living in modern cities, and what would that look like? This attempts to tackle that. As you said, we get a lot of exposition. It's like drinking from a fire hose trying to build this world in a hurry, so we can get to the buddy cop aspect of this movie. I think they did that really well. We get a lot. I don't know that it's some of it's carried off better than others. But like, for example, you were really taken with the opening credits.
Yeah. The credit sequence, it sort of exposits through graffiti. One is a Banksy-style picture of it's a stencil graffiti of the cops beating an orc. And there's an elf girl in the foreground, and her shirt says, Elf-E. And she is taking an over-the-shoulder selfie of herself in front of the beating.
That already tells you so much about this world.
We're kind of quickly sketched a world where, at one point, orcs were the bad guys, and all this is like almost on a biblical time frame. There is an elvish mythological figure called the Dark Lord, who is in no way Voldemort or anybody else of that nature.
Saruman.
Definitely.
Saruman.
Definitely not Candle.
Uh-oh! Maybe he didn't hear it.
Hello, boys. Scream.
What?
Oh, okay. I thought you were taken by Candle Jack.
Don't say it!
What?
Candle Jack!
Oops.
Why, thank you.
Be careful. Nobody say Candle Jack.
Candle Jack!
I'm gonna need more rope.
Scream.
Is that one inside now? Do you think that'll play?
The Candlejack joke?
Yeah, let's...
Maybe. Let us know. Write in, hit us up on Facebook, and let us know if you understand the Candlejack reference.
Scream.
But yeah, so we have a prehistorical Dark Lord. We have a apparently kind of human supremacist organization called the the Shield of Light. We're pretty much introduced the fact that the elves are the shiny people and the orcs are kind of
the said culture, I guess.
Yeah, get your humans caught in the middle. We do see there are some other fantasy creatures that are touched on lightly. Dwarves are mentioned but not shown. Fairies are presented as like an infestation you can get in your house. There are a few. They look like mounted police, and then you realize they're centaurs. So we have all this kind of world building going on, and there's a lot of it. The other thing we're quickly introduced, like orc culture is very focused on their orcish clan, and it's apparently quite a big deal. So we have all this cooking. We haven't even
gotten to the plot yet.
Yeah. They get a call. They report to the call. It turns out that the location is a safe house. It's very heavily armed and fortified. They're fired on. They return fire. They end up kicking in the door, doing some cop stuff. The dust settles. They're in possession of a magic wand and a lost elf girl that does not speak any English or anything. She speaks the elvish language, which both elves and orcs have their own distinct tongue. And then we get a little more know-how here. It turns out the magic wand is a great big deal.
Yeah, magic in this world is very rare. And only certain people can even touch the wand with their bare skin. And those people are special magic users, so...
Known as they're the titular brights.
Yeah, so you look at this world and, you know, when you think of sword and sorcery and Gandalf the Grey and Merlin and figures like that, and how in some stories, especially if you look at like Arthurian legend, for example, Merlin was just, he was one character. He was the one magic user out of the whole troop there. They kind of take the same tack here, where even to be a magic user is a rare accomplishment or birthright. And then that's winnowed down even further by the scarcity of these wands, which possess all power. We get a little bit of a clue as to the stratification of the world, that there are more magic users among elves than there are people. And so the elves are the one percenters. They're the rich guys. They live in a super elite part of town that is very clean and very stylized. And they are very rich and very trendy and very beautiful people. And then for, you know, a smaller percent of the magic users among them, there's human magic users, and then apparently that's it. If there are orcish magic users or dwarven magic users, we just don't know. But it leads me to a couple weird questions that we'll get to at the end about what the overall message here is. But Matt, there's a lot of political and social allegory tied up on top of the massive amount of exposition that we get. And I think building the world and then building our world on top of that world as kind of an illusion, I think that's where this gets a lot of its bloat.
And where it gets a little muddy. One thing, I mean, it's obvious that Will Smith is African-American.
Yeah.
I think everyone was aware of that. I may not have needed to mention it. It's not made super clear to us exactly how American history played out with all this other stuff altering it. So we don't know what the civil rights process was in America. We don't know. Were the black people still oppressed, or were the orcs the slaves? You know?
Right.
We don't have that all sorted out for us. And I don't know how you would do it, because the movie definitely didn't need...
It didn't need more time added to it.
It didn't need, especially not talking to the screen, runtime.
We talk about economy of exposition a lot on the show. And one of the criticisms that this movie has gotten that we both kind of cocked our head and said, I don't know that we watched the same movie, was that there wasn't enough exposition, that they didn't explain enough. And to a certain degree, I can kind of see where things were set up and not necessarily paid off that might lead you to think that. But I really think that this suffers from a little too much exposition that was not particularly deftly handled. We have that weird double magic of not only is it urban fantasy, but it is also an allegory for the actual human society outside. We don't parse it in a very skillful way, I guess.
And that's where it's very hard to speculate as to authorial intent, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I almost think more allegory here is being read than was deliberately encoded. Now, I think some of it is on purpose, like they definitely did. I feel like they were working off the visual from previous urban fantasy, like the idea that the orcs are going to look cool as a gang. that the elves are going to look cool in snazzy suits and uptown couture and stuff, that's really taking. And frankly, these are established tropes of a subgenre that's not broadly popular, but is intensely popular with its fans. So you have those deep running Shadowrun and Dresden Files fans and stuff that Supernatural fans that they've worked in this urban fantasy milieu in their head a lot. I don't know, because there's almost like a painful lack of awareness of irony with Will Smith's character, where he's so surly toward the poor orc guy who is basically a golden retriever.
Okay, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we've got Will Smith and Joel Edgerton. Great performances from both of them, sincerely. And like I said, I think they gave the performances that they were written. But I do think that Ward, who is Will Smith's character, was he's just a little too hard. And Jacoby, the orcish character, was just a little too soft. And once again, that's a writing problem, to where I didn't feel particularly that Will Smith's redemption was necessarily as sincere as I think they needed it to be. You know, he kind of has a strange arc in this that I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but it doesn't feel quite as realistic. And then Jacoby, the orc character, is almost so naive. You question how he became a cop in L.A.
Oh, yeah, that's not good.
Yes.
Then we could die.
First time being shot at?
Yeah. I have to say, I dislike him very much.
Oh! You all right?
Yeah. No holes?
Huh? Only the ones that I was born with.
How are your holes?
Can you make a shootout awkward?
Sorry.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is, because he's the first and only orc that has a lot of lines for a while, it's almost like a characterization that they're all like this. Because those scenes reminded me of Alien Nation, where the guy was naive about human civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Which, in my opinion, is the other thing this lifts from liberally, is the who was it in the original movie, James Caan. Then there was a spin-off TV series.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like he doesn't know about human civilization that he ostensibly grew up in. And then we also find out that he's a bad orc. Like, he's failed their society in some way. He's from a bad bloodline of orcs. And so he's not a member of one of their all-important orc clans. And the local one is the Fogteeth, who are kind of a sort of mishmash of, you know, they wear football and hockey jerseys and biker cuts, and they just sort of look like gangs in a blender.
Mm-hmm.
But then we meet some of the Fogteeth, and they're kind of interesting. Like, I thought one of the strongest scenes in this is when we see the Fogteeth headquarters and meet their leader, who is Brad Dahlke, the guy that plays the head guard in Orange is the New Black.
Mm-hmm.
He introduces some of their actual sort of interior culture, and it's kind of, those are some cool atmospheric scenes in this weird condemned church that they've commandeered. And it's just, the hits are hard hits, and the misses are really committed whiffs, you know?
Yeah. Like, okay, so, for example, when we talked about Suicide Squad, another David Ayer's project, I illustrated what I called How Do You Get Harley Into an Elevator, and it was just basically a big, long explanation of one giant. It's not even really a plot hole as much as it's kind of a continuity error. But it's one of those things that just kind of leaves you going, come on, guys, if you had looked at the script twice, you could have fixed this. And it wouldn't have taken me out of the moment. And there's a lot of moments like that in Bright. For example, when when our two heroes are approaching the safe house, they start taking fire. They duck behind a car. There's some interplay. There's some buddy cop moments in there. Once they kill the guy that's in the window, they enter the building.
Yeah, yeah. Like, Jacoby calls it in. And then that's where the four corrupt, the backup are the ones they end up shooting.
Well, and that's the next thing, is that when backup shows up, it's four cops, no rescue, no feds, no crime scene technicians. And then the feds do eventually show up and kind of take over the scene, but then they're quickly dispatched by a group of elvish terrorists. And when we go back to the location later in the movie, theoretically several hours later, they go back and the place is still littered with bodies. And there's still no cleanup. There's still no crime scene techs. There's still no officers on.
I see your complaint, but
I mean, basically, LAPD commentary on effectiveness notwithstanding, it's just, it feels like lazy writing. It feels like we couldn't write ourselves out of this, so we just we stuck with it, you know.
Yeah, it was a little I didn't have quite, it didn't get quite the reverse traction with it, with me that it did with you, because I sort of interpreted this movie as taking almost as long as it took.
As kind of a real time thing,
like because it's almost like kind of one long chase. Several things relied on somebody not coming back and blocks in a busy city being dark. Now they do depict that it's a gang neighborhood and the gang really runs it. That's actually part of a key action sequence. So there is that, but evidently the terrorists felt it was run down enough to hide them in the first place. But now you're getting into that layer of arguing headcanon. Why don't we just talk about how the force works? You know, we're arguing arguments that could have been settled with defter world building, you know.
And that's just kind of the problem, is that I think on paper this movie plays for me. However, in execution, the effectiveness of the storytelling tools in play just did not function for me. Looking specifically at the writing and the direction. You know, there's a couple of continuity errors here and there. It feels like this one wasn't quite done, and I'm certain it wasn't worth 90 mil. You know, another problem I had is we've built this world of orcs and elves and dwarves and centaurs and all this. We really don't get to see it. There's one scene where they kind of blow through an orc stronghold, and then later on we're in kind of the throne room that you discussed. But it's not like we see orcs and goblins on the street corner, you know, selling tacos. There's not a lot of day-to-day life. And it was kind of weird for me, because originally they really featured LA as an on-location location. You know, you're driving by central LA landmarks. When they drive through the elvish part of town, that is central downtown LA, and it's very pristine. But when we do start to go to the barrio and into these neighborhoods that are run by either humans of color or orcs, it's not as recognizable. It looks like a backlot. And, you know, it's just, here we built part of an alley and filled it with a lot of fog. And for being in Los Angeles, it's raining an awful lot, too. I won't never be nothing, ain't that something? I've risen from the bottom, I got them eyes on the prize, and inside I'm damn right I overcame. Y'all know the name, we similar but never been the same. Everybody, yeah, they know the name. Right now, I'ma make it somehow, make it somehow. Now again, these are all very minor quibbles, but they're just things that I'm like, huh. It seems like they could have, well, okay.
I want to say that feels like a choice to me.
Uh-huh.
Like they made a decision. They want to make it clear that the fantasy elements are mundane to the people who live there. It did have that side effect of like, and then at one point they do something like they show a dragon flying over the skyline. Well,
that bothered me.
It's a cool idea. It's a cool idea. Oh, there's a dragon flying around over LA. But then you want to know, like, well,
isn't that a big deal?
What role do the giant reptiles have in the ecosystem? Do they just eat the bums? What are they?
Well, yeah, and so, like, I noticed that, too, and I actually took note of it to bring it up, because it seems to me that a dragon, now, I don't know what dragons are in this world, but traditionally...
Well, they have one beefy arm.
Consummate feast, consummate! It seems like that would be at least as serious as a mountain lion sighting, and that there would probably be people watching it, spotlighting it. It seems like it would be a big deal. And if you're going to have that in there, deal with it.
Maybe dragons are really hammy and dramatic.
And you know, and that could be. Maybe dragons in this universe are just super...
Yeah, don't make eye contact. It's flying down here. It's going to want change. Don't give it. It likes gold coins. Give it the Sacagawea dollars.
But see, and
don't give it the real gold.
You know, and we've talked about on the show before, and it, you know, I think we need to parse this line for our listeners that, you know, yeah, there are certain situations where they don't tell you the backstory of Lord Snoke because it's not important to the time. Yes, I understand that. But there are just like weird plot holes in this where it's like everybody's after the magic wand. But only certain people can use the magic wand, and those people are supposedly very rare, and we are also led to believe perhaps very heavily regulated by the government. And so when the Barrio gang gets their hands on it, what are they going to do with it? I mean, how hard is it to find a magic user who will not only pledge themselves to your wishes, but also not betray you? When it's become obvious that having this MacGuffin in play, this is so desirable that it really just causes people to turn around.
Well, then the other thing is everybody's fighting over the wand. Most of the people can't touch the wand. Some of the people in our group can touch the wand. So why don't they just touch people with the wand? Like, there's a lot here that...
It looked like when somebody touched the wand, it actually had an area of effect where it would blow up and then take out, like, maybe people in a 3 or 4 foot radius around you. That was observed, but it was not... presented well. It's like, oh wait, what happened there, and how does that work, and can a bright just go up and touch somebody with the wand, and would they die? And so it's not parsed well, and it takes you out of the moment, and that's kind of the key, and that's the difference. Is yeah, they don't explain Lord Snoke, and we have questions about Lord Snoke after the movie, but it doesn't take me out of the moment to try and figure out where he's coming from, you know.
Yeah, I think, well, and we could wade back into the Lord Snoke thing. I think they'd made a deliberate choice to not bother telling, like that was part of their thesis.
Yeah, I agree.
Screw this backstory.
Or maybe a better example would be Immortan Joe in Mad Max Fury Road, to call back to that.
Yeah, precisely enough is already implied about him.
Right. And I think just for as much emphasis as we put on the fact that mortal beings cannot touch these magic wands, it really begs the question when it comes up. And so you're left just kind of scratching your head, and it takes you out of the movie for a minute.
This is getting pretty granular. This is getting into light spoilers.
Actually, yeah. Why don't we go ahead and throw up our traditional spoiler curtain? Cause we're coming up towards the back half of the episode here. Folks, if you haven't seen Bright, I'd give it a 50% recommend. It's nothing spectacular. It's pretty easily forgotten. But I do want to say that I think part of what they did here was actually very interesting. And I would like to see it in the hands of maybe another writer, which is where it looks like it's going. So I'm eager to see where they go with this. So I guess I'd probably recommend it a little more handily than, say, Justice League or Batman versus Superman. I think it was better than both of those movies. But it's a middle of the road.
I don't know if I'd quite go better than Justice League, but yeah, it's decent. I think if you watch the trailer, you'll know if it's in your lane or not. And if you think it might not be, maybe don't commit the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, should we here? Boop.
All right, folks, well, we are behind the spoiler curtain. We're going to be getting rich into spoiler territory here, talking about the big reveals in this movie. And I don't know that the spoiler alert was necessary, because a lot of these you can see coming.
Yeah.
Another complaint about the writing. But
the big one, the movie, the problem with plot, there's plot holes, then there's sort of world-building holes that are sketched in things that can maybe be explained later. When they find the protagonist elf, Tika, the wielder of the wand that is at in contention, she's one of the people who stands to inherit this wand. And the antagonist is the quote unquote rightful owner of it, that is the big bad. When they find her, she's addled and scared and only communicates in Elvish. Well, she speaks English and she just pretends not to the whole time. And this leads to them missing several pieces of information, like the fact that there's a curse on the wand that will only let it go so far from the other owner. And when that curse kicks in, they're in a car and it causes the equivalent of a full head-on collision as though they just hit a wall. And she's sitting there panicking, screaming at them in Elvish, which they don't really, Jacoby understands a little bit of it.
He took a little in high school.
Yeah, he has to Pigden translate it for Ward. She's screaming. She's obviously supposed to sincerely be panicked, but she commits. And then later she says, well, I just didn't trust you guys yet, so I didn't want to give up that I knew English. Well, it's obviously completely abnormal for one of these metahumans, I guess is the term they use in Shadowrun, but for an elf or an orc to only speak the elf orc language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's super remarkable. And then for her to then she's like, I am so suspicious of you guys that I'm going to let you drive your car into a wall before I break into English, even though I'm trying to stop you in Elvish as hard as I can. And there were several other things that she just didn't. She could have just explained to them that she didn't. Like she has the ability to hide the wand on her in like a pocket of holding. Like she can just hide it sort of on or in her person, you know, it merges with her body kind of. And so they're packing it around physically, handling it with literal kid gloves because they can't touch it. And the whole time they could have stashed it a different way. There's quite a bit wrong with the way that's handled, and it does kind of chunk up the movie.
Well, and the fact of the matter is she is also a bright and can handle the wand and can use it, and it seems to take a lot out of her. But you know, it's another thing where it's
when that's clarified, we're told she's like she's an apprentice. Mm-hmm. She only knows a little bit of how to operate it. But apparently she knows enough to kill people with it and bring back the dead.
Right.
So, which that could just be, I mean, that would justify the gravity with which the wand is being treated if that's what an apprentice can do. What happens when it gets back to the owner?
Right.
And she's still mad, you know? that actually does bring me to something that worked for me. I liked the trio of bad elves, like Rapace and her bodyguard. She has a match set of kind of a male and a female sort of twinned elves that defend her, and the elves are really kind of creepy in this. They kind of make them look sort of like Galadriel in Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. They're very inhuman looking, and they have sharp. They have sharp shark teeth, and it's implied and iridescent eyes. It's kind of implied that even though they look like pretty people, their actual biology is quite a bit different. And the elves are kind of and this is something they took some flack for, is like the wire work with the elves, but it worked for me.
It worked for me too, I'm not a big fan of wire work either.
I thought the elves looked like they showcased that they were fast and skilled as opposed to the orcs, which were brute strong. Like at one point, they show an orc who is not particularly, he's not the biggest orc in the movie, and he's picking up the front end of an F-250.
Yeah.
So that someone can slide under it.
This is another thing that just didn't make sense to me. That's there to showcase that orcs are strong. But what he is doing is he is lifting the front end of this vehicle so a kid can get underneath and pick up a soccer ball.
Yeah.
But the kid is of a size where he literally could have just scuttled under the truck and picked it up like normal, you know? And so that's another one that just kind of took me out of the moment going.
Then the other thing is like it could just be that the example they seized on is not something they're particularly well versed in. So they were kind of underthinking what they were implying.
Mm-hmm.
But if Jacoby's that strong, there's situations like in the movie where they're like locked in a room and he could patently just rip the door off. And he does showcase a little, like at one point he's run over and he pushes the car off. He's clearly stronger than a person his size. And then there are a few other, like they mentioned that the orcs can play in the NFL, but they always, they're sort of confined to the line because they don't have very good reflexes. And at one point when Jacoby and Ward almost come to blows, the Ward just goes, you know, you can't beat me to the draw. Like he says it like it's a biological fact,
mm-hmm.
You know? And so there's some some of that is just touched on a little bit, but it's never quantified. They never tell you orcs are 100% stronger and 50% as fast, and elves are 100% fast, and, you know. But I liked the action scenes with the elf baddies. I liked the sort of druidic culture of the orcs when it's sort of delved into.
Nobody knows where they came from or where they were.
Or what they were doing.
But their legacy remains. Hewn into the living rock of Stone Age.
You know,
I thought we'd be above Puppet Show on the marquee, Trevor. Just Nighthawks podcast, then Puppet Show.
I did want to talk a little bit about some of the real or perceived social allegory here before we wrap things up. We obviously have some societal stand-ins here. The elves are the 1%. The humans are the middle class. The orcs are the trod-upon culture. Is the movie making a social message of it? Was that effective, if so, and did that message communicate?
I don't know if it was intended and not affected, or if it was not intended and it's being overread, but somehow it didn't quite come out in the wash. And part of it is because the orcs and the elves exist, but they don't appear to have displaced anybody. So the elves are rich and live in an enclave, but there are also still rich humans. So it's not clear. A piece I read on it used the phrase, the orcs are heavily coded as working class Latinos. Right? I'd say that's fair, but the problem is there are also quote-unquote working-class Latinos in the movie.
In the movie, yeah.
So they haven't displaced anybody upward. And that also makes, the minority members of the police, Margaret Cho, and who does a good against type turn in this, is the mean, mean desk sergeant.
Yeah.
she's one of the meaner cops in the unit of corrupt cops. So you have all that going on, and it's not clear how the presence or absence of orcs affects the intra-human race relationships, if we're all one big happy family now that we have somebody else to poop on.
Right.
I think they tried to do some of that, but they didn't focus their exposition on the places where it would make their allegory functional.
I mean, kind of obviously not, though, because even Will Smith in the beginning of the movie is hollering at his neighbors, and he's using some pretty unkind language. Now, I don't know if the characters who live next door to Will Smith's character are genuinely gang members, but that's kind of the language that Will Smith used. And so it's like, well, okay, there are orcs, and then there's an urban human element to it. But then when the orcish cop pulls up to pick up Will Smith for his duty, he gets ticked off at the orc and says, "What are you doing showing up to my house? Why are you on my lawn?" As if he's going to be judged by the people that he just looked down his nose at, you know?
To me, that played like his neighbors weren't supposed to be aware he was cops.
You know, that played for me too.
But his neighbors
didn't care.
address him as officer and mention to each other, "Check it out, I live next to this crazy old cop."
You know? And, you know, they talk about, you know, take out that fairy LAPD style. And what it did for me, though, is it really did paint Will Smith's character as that kind of that dirty, surly, grungy, rough around the edges type. But as I said earlier, it almost put him too far in that direction to where he wasn't likable, which for Will Smith is hard to do. He's an actor that usually plays a character that I'll warm up to at least some aspect of. And he was just kind of downright mean in this. And especially to Jacoby, who is so likable. I mean, you said it before, the dude's basically a Labrador.
Part of their characterization is that they're on the street doing a patrol, a foot patrol outside of a business when a robber runs out of it. And Jacoby is buying them lunch. So the guy runs out with his, you know, shotgun in hand, and he puts a round into Will Smith. And then ultimately we learn the bulletproof vest stopped it. He lived, but he's not happy with Jacoby. Well, this is something I noticed because I watched this twice, and because I watched it before you suggested it.
Mm-hmm. And then once
and so I went, I watched again this afternoon so I'd be fresh on it. While Jacoby's getting burritos, Will Smith is on his phone texting. So he's like, he's just as culpable in the inattention.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this element of like he's taking, and then later when he's desperate to get replaced, He's trying to get Jacoby out of his car. The desk sergeant says, Ward, no one else wants to ride with you. Like, so either he's some kind of Serpico where he's too good of a cop, or there's something wrong with him where they don't want to be around him. He's a jinxed or...
See, and that was also kind of a weird line. It's like Will Smith is super angry about being partnered with an orc. He wants to circumnavigate the system to get him out of the car, but he does have a line that he's not going to cross. You know, he's not going to go full dirty cop and do it that way, but he's still not wholly above board. And so it's kind of an odd line to parse. And I think the redemption that they intended for him when he's, for example, defending Jacoby when Jacoby's not around diminishes a little bit. And so he's not quite as redemptive by the time that they need him that way. One thing I did want to bring up is that it kind of in the same vein, there's this sub story about the first time the Dark Lord was banished and sent away. And it was a uniting of all of the species. And it came at the hands of this orc named Jirak, who was an unblooded black sheep orc, much like Jacoby, who united all of the clans, and through their united effort were able to fell the Dark Lord. So by the end of this movie, Jacoby becomes a latter-day blooded orc. He saves the day. He earns his place in their culture. He is resurrected from the dead. He helps save the day. But at the end of the movie, who is our hero? We discussed throughout the film that Will Smith is some kind of character from prophecy. It turns out that he's a Bright, and because of that, he ends up saving the day. And so much like Jirak didn't get any credit for toppling the Dark Lord, Jacoby kind of plays backseat, where it's like, yeah, you did most of the heavy lifting here, but the human is the one with the birthright. And so he gets top honors. And so I don't know if that was a commentary or if that was a misfire on a commentary, or maybe I should stop reading into it because a cigar is a cigar.
It's not absolutely confirmed that he's a Bright. What happens is he handles the wand and isn't destroyed by it. So maybe it's because he was like pure of heart when he picked it up and wasn't wishing for anybody's death or rebirth or destruction. You know, he could have picked it up without trying to use it. And somehow stumbled through the momentary handling of it. But I think that's incorrect. I think he's intended to be a Bright in the fall.
Yeah, I think he's the elvish girl gives him the magic words. And I think Jacoby even says, ooh, you're a Bright. And so it's so weird to see a movie that's talking about, okay, no matter who we are all people. The little girl, Will Smith's little girl at the beginning of this, has a very precocious moment where at first, she's kind of saying, well, orcs are dumb. And Will Smith has to sit her down and say, no, honey, everybody's everybody. Orcs are people, too. And she kind of throws that back at him. And so we have this thesis of, you know, we're all created equal at birth, except for Will Smith, who is actually a little bit extra. And so that just that didn't set well with me at all.
Well, I guess you can call that in a certain sense realistic, because real people do struggle with that stuff. But this didn't feel like that. This felt like it felt like two drafts smashed together. Like that. That's really.
Yeah.
It felt like there was a draft where he was R-rated, where he was Denzel in Training Day, and then it felt like there was a draft where he was Serpico. You know what I mean? And they just tried to make an average out of it. I don't know that you get sometimes the average of two functional approaches is just nothing. You know, sometimes if you use the legs of a corgi and the torso of a bull, you don't get a magnificent creature. you just get something that perches on its belly and can't make much forward time.
So I ultimately, Matt, last thoughts.
I'm going to lean on what I said before. I think when you look at Bright, probably going to know if it's in your lane. I have to come back to this, even though the property is somewhat niche. There's been some video games and some adaptions and stuff, but there's a pen and paper role-playing game called Shadowrun that is done, and it's got two or three really good like isolinear adventure games on Steam. So they're like kind of throwback tactical RPGs.
Mm-hmm.
It does most of what this does better. This was clearly made to appeal to fans of this genre. The problem is it does so much uncredited derivation, and it does so much less distinctly that I think if you look, if you're a Shadowrun fan and you look at this and you go, oh, that looks like the thing I like, and you're going to watch it, you're going to go, oh, it's the thing I like, but not as good. So I think they're going to mess up in their own cut, you know?
Yeah. What I will say is I'm on board for a sequel. A lot of the criticism that at least happened on my wall from a lot of people was, and you mentioned this before, that people thought it felt like a pilot for a TV series. And honestly, I think this could have done better as a TV series. I don't know what that would have done to their overall plan. I don't know that you can make a TV series with the effects that they had in this film and still have it come out the same on your bottom line. I don't know that you can get Will Smith to commit to, a 13-episode series, but I think this would have worked better in longer form, especially since I promise this is just a commentary on his writing and not the person, but this just was not a tightly written script, and if you're not good at cramming a lot of exposition in, and some people are very good at it, we've talked about several of them on the show before, if you're not good at it, sometimes it's okay to take more time to build those worlds.
I cannot believe that this is a $3 million script. He had to be in a room with two producers and somehow got them in a pissing contest where one of them was just going, I'll give you $1.25 for it. Oh, I'll give you $1.50, you know. Mm-hmm. It had to be a situation where two people didn't want to capitulate. There's no other way, because this is a very mundane treatment of these ideas. Like, it's very... Even down to some of the stuff like, he's the Dark Lord. He's not there. They're the Fog Teeth, which is kind of a rando orc name. You know, it's not very, it's an obvious sort of honorific name. And then what is the MacGuffin? It's a magic wand. It's not the wand of so-and-so. It's not the wand of what's this. It's not even something maybe a little less Harry Potterish than a wand. I actually thought they were going to do the Jewel of the Nile. I thought it was going to turn out to be the girl the whole time.
Mm.
But, I just...
Nice shout out to Jewel of the Nile, by the way.
Yeah. Both of those are kind of great.
Yeah, I think that's a future episode right there.
Yeah.
And what gets really funny is if you follow it up with The War of the Roses, where it's the same three actors, but it's a pitch black comedy about divorce.
I'm a little bit terrified to watch those and find out they're super racist.
Ooh, yeah. Good question.
Yeah, they were pretty... adventure in a place that exists is always like fraught with, well, why is this? Oh, what makes it such an exotic destination? You know, here's the thing. I don't think anybody, I want Joel Edgerton and Noomi Rapace to get, we cannot figure out her name. Nobody, neither of us can say it like she says it. We tried off mic.
We tried.
But the two of them in particular do great, pretty good performances in on both of them in makeup, you know. And I want the genre to succeed. So even though Bright's not the it's not the candidate I would have wanted in a perfect world,
Well, you know, it's important to say we've had success stories like that before. Resident Evil is not the greatest zombie movie in the world, but it predated 28 Days Later, and you know, so if we can support this, maybe we'll get some better entries down the road.
That lukewarm endorsement, I think, is going to be my final word on that.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty much with you. I didn't think my time was wasted here. I was entertained for most of the time I was watching it. I had some moments where it took me out. That's unfortunate. I think the directing is a little shaky. I think the writing is even shakier. But overall, I'm not going to recommend anybody not watch it. If it's something you're interested in, definitely check it out. One last thing I wanted to tackle just real quick, Matt. The Netflix distribution model here, they're coming out with a lot of content. Like, a lot of content. More stand-up specials than you can shake a stick at. We've got TV shows coming out the wazoo here. We now have this $90 million tentpole film. Obviously, Netflix seems to know what they're doing. They seem to be making money. It seems to be working, from what I can tell. Matt, do you think they're releasing too much content? Because I've heard that as a criticism.
You know, I don't. And I think what's the worst case for them? They split their channel, like a Netflix originals release channel that's an add-on. I don't think they're going broke now that we've done that terrifying math. Wow, that's so many people. That's almost. I mean, That's nearly every household in America, or a significant portion of the TV watching world. Mm-hmm. But that's not even counting all the people that their passwords are shared with.
Right.
The issue with Netflix is what Netflix is to you, what it is to you. And so, like, I throw up my Netflix, it looks quite a bit different from my mom's.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's a real problem with Netflix content crowding itself out.
I do think there is a little legitimacy, though. And this is something, there is actually a swath of film fandom that really dislikes Netflix. I think that's a little unfair, but there is something to be said that sometimes it can be harder to find unique content because there is so much of it out there. Now, I'm going to make the counter argument that if Hush hadn't been released on Netflix, I probably never would have seen it otherwise. And so I think the good stuff does have a way of rising to the top. But I think Netflix needs a better PR model. I think they have this great habit of saying, oh, by the way, we have a new show coming up in 2 weeks. They just did that with David Letterman. He's got a new interview show. They just announced it 2 weeks ago. And so that's really exciting because it gives you that feeling that you used to get when you'd go to the movies and you'd see a trailer for a movie you hadn't heard about yet. In the age of the internet, that's incredibly hard to do anymore. And so to have that is really cool. And I think there's some good aspects to it, but I think a lot of it's getting lost in the cracks too. And I think a lot of stuff that's really quality. So what I'd like to see from Netflix is a better model of public relations and marketing, you know, to maybe try and sell me on these a little bit differently. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I think they're doing an okay job. I think we are losing a lot of library content from Netflix, but at the same time, there are so many other streaming services now to fill that hole. Even if you have two or three streaming services, it's still less than you're paying for cable. So I'm not going anywhere anytime soon.
I don't know that they can do that much. I mean, what are you going to do? Slink back to cable with commercials? Have you tried that lately?
Yeah, it's hard.
It's pure agony. Why are we?
I had to upgrade my Hulu package, man. That stuff was getting, ugh.
Yeah, but, well, are we headed off for some pie?
I think it's about time for some pie. Folks, be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter. We are on Stitcher. Find us there. Subscribe. Leave us a review and a rating. Do the same for us over on iTunes. Do the same for us however you listen. And ultimately, really what we would love you to do is if you're enjoying the podcast, A, let us know, and B, let your friends know. We'd love to be in your friend's head, in their ear holes. So, yeah, keep circulating those tapes and spread the word. Matt, any final parting missives, little epistles?
Please play my mixtape.
All right, folks, I think with that, I'm Trevor Trujillo.
And I'm Matt Foster.
And we are going to sign off because it's almost morning. Hey, folks, thanks for sticking around the Nighthawks Diner kind of after the show, hanging out for that ever-present coffee and pie. Having coffee and pie with me tonight, Matt, we gave the night off. He had a comedy gig to run and do. But we have a special guest in the cafe for just a little bit of an update, maybe a little bit of a preview of an episode to come. Cameron Maris, returning to the show. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Trevor.
Yeah, it's really good to have you. Have you been healthy? We tried to have you on earlier in the year, and things just didn't work out. We wanted to bring you back earlier, but now it's already awards season.
Yeah, things have been good. It's been a weird 2017, I think, for all of us. I think weird's the only word I can think of for it. But it's always great to get to awards season because, you know, after a rough year, it's nice to kind of reflect on a year. Think about what moved us in the world of cinema.
First off, Cameron, where are we in awards season? It's not Oscar time. We don't have the nominees yet. And that's kind of where the Nighthawks gets their skin in the game, is the Oscar race. That's the big one. That's the lionized award. But there's a whole season around these. And so where are we now?
Well, Oscar, I guess awards season sort of unofficially kicks off late in the year, sort of November and December, when the big prestige movies start coming out. And the ones that are sort of timed specifically so that people will watch them during the time that they're thinking about what the best movies of the year are, when the lists are coming out, top 10 lists and things like that. And so I guess where we're at now is we're sort of smack dab in the middle of the run-up to the nominations. Academy voting started on January 5th, and it ends, I believe, January 12th, and the nominations will then be announced on January 23rd. The Golden Globes are sort of a good kickoff to Oscar season, as it works, because it sort of gives us an idea of who the front runners are, what the movies are that are going to be in contention. And it happens right around the time that Oscar voting starts. So it really, you know, it's prevalent in the minds of voters as they're filling out their ballots. So the Golden Globes happened just a couple nights ago as we are recording this. And so it sort of puts us right in the middle of voting season. And we're sort of getting an idea of, as to who the front runners are going to be.
So that's my next question, is the Golden Globes then are usually kind of a precursor or an indicator, I guess, of the Oscars.
Sometimes, generally, not always.
I guess what happened at the Golden Globes? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, it was sort of an unpredictable year. There's no real one front runner, I think, in this race. There's a lot of movies that have gotten a lot of buzz. And I think in the end, it was sort of, no one really knew how this was going to shake out. At the Globes, the Best Picture prizes went to, for in the drama category, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. And in the comedy category, Best Picture went to Lady Bird. The Best Actor in the drama category went to Gary Oldman for his performance as Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour. And Best Actor in a comedy went to James Franco for his performance as Tommy Wiseau in The Disaster Artist.
Hi, doggy.
Best Actress prizes went to Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird for comedy, and Frances McDormand for Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri for drama. The Best Director prize went to Guillermo del Toro for The Shape of Water. So, I mean, it was really spread out as far as the big categories go. And yeah, it's sort of giving us an idea of how things are going to shape up for the nominations, but I don't think anybody really has an idea of who the real front runner would be for Best Picture at this point, as far as a winner goes.
So Cameron, moving forward, what are the things we need to watch?
This is actually my favorite part of the Oscar season as far as making predictions go, because this is sort of where we can kind of go wild in speculating about who could possibly be nominated. The Best Picture category is always exciting because we'll have anywhere between 5 and 10 nominees, so we can kind of get an idea of where the tiers are and sort of take a look at who is leading in a wide variety of categories. I think one of the big things to watch right now is The Shape of Water. That is Guillermo del Toro's latest movie. Of course, he is the director of Pan's Labyrinth, and sort of known as a visionary fantasy genre director.
Mm-hmm.
But his new film, The Shape of Water, is, I guess, I haven't seen it yet, but it is a romance involving some sort of sea creature, merman sort of thing. and it is actually trending, I think, right now to get the most nominations out of any movie. I could actually see it getting upward of about 14 nominations or so.
Ooh.
If it were to do that, of course, it would tie the record previously set by 3 different movies, including one last year. That'd be All About Eve, Titanic, and La La Land. Last year, 14 nominations is the most number of nominations that any movie has gotten in a single year. It kind of achieves that by just being really doing really well, probably in the artistic and technical categories. All of Guillermo del Toro's movies do well in those categories generally. It also has 3 performers who are trending really highly in their categories. And getting 3 acting nominations is sort of one of the easiest ways to get to something like 14 nominations. And I think that, of course, that shows popularity in a wide field of categories, and that might make The Shape of Water the front runner for the season, even though the Globes went to two different movies besides that for Best Picture.
You haven't had a chance to listen to the episode yet, but we've been talking about Bright from Netflix, which has received kind of a mixed reaction, but there is a little bit of Oscar buzz around that one. It got shortlisted for something, didn't it?
Well, yeah, actually, it's a pretty good segue because the shortlist for the makeup and hairstyling category has been released. They narrowed that field down to 7 films already, and one of those movies is Bright. Actually, conveniently, the makeup artist for Bright was actually last year's Oscar winner for Suicide Squad, also directed by David Ayer. Also directed by David Ayer. It shares a lot of the cast, I think, as well. It's very possible that Bright will slide in there for a makeup nomination, probably nothing else for that one. But it's in the top 7. It is a tight category, though, because the makeup and hairstyling field is generally limited to 3 nominations in the end. So it's a little tougher to get in that category. But from what I've seen and what I've heard, the makeup is pretty extraordinary.
So, and there is precedent and they, for it was. The makeup was actually quite good. I don't think we got to touch on that sufficiently during the episode. But what else are we kind of indicating for the Oscars? What are we looking at? And do you have any predictions at this point?
I've got a whole list of predictions.
I knew you would.
Generally, I think we're probably looking at 8 to 9 Best Picture nominees. I think that Christopher Nolan's World War II movie Dunkirk is going to do quite well. I think that it'll be one of the nomination leaders besides The Shape of Water, which I think could, once again, get 12, 13, possibly 14 nominations. Steven Spielberg's film The Post, starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep together for the first time on screen, I think that's going to do very well. I think that it's very timely. People are looking at that and seeing allusions to sort of the present day socio-political situation and the implications there. And I just think it's pretty extraordinary that Meryl Streep has never been directed by Steven Spielberg before, and she's never acted with Tom Hanks before. That's crazy to think about. And so obviously that's just all kinds of Oscar bait. So I think that it'll probably do very well, and we'll probably see a handful of nominations for that. Other movies that I think are going to probably be looking like they'll get into the Best Picture race, the romance Call Me By Your Name. Of course, we've talked a little bit about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Martin McDonagh's new picture. It's going to do very well. I think that we'll see a good amount of nominations for that. Other movies like Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman, probably being the real front runner for Best Actor. Lady Bird, which is probably one of the front runners for Best Picture, and I think probably for Best Director as well. I'm looking to see Greta Gerwig included in that top 5 list.
You know, she's a director now, but that's an actress whose career I started following back in 2007, and then she's kind of gone on and done other things. So it's kind of exciting for me. And not on top of that, Lady Bird is one of the few nominees that I've actually managed to see this year so far. So I'm actually kind of excited for that one. Super nice woman, very gracious, and I'm really hoping the best for her.
Well, and she could become part of a rarefied group, which is women that have been nominated for the Oscar for Best Director. I could actually see her getting nominations for Best Director and Best Screenplay this year, and Best Picture, actually, and quite possibly winning one or maybe even all 3 of those. Other movies to watch, I think, this year for the award season are films like Mudbound and Get Out, which...
I'm really hoping that does something, too. At least something. I mean, it's the Oscars are notorious for just turning a blind eye to horror, but...
I think that Get Out has some socio-political implications that go beyond just being a horror movie that I think are quite attractive to Oscar voters. And, of course, we've talked about on this podcast in the last couple of years the diversification of the Academy itself. And I think that they're going to be looking – I think the Academy is looking, especially in a year like this, is looking toward movies that have something to say about – our current situations, And I think Get Out is one of those movies, despite the fact that it's a horror movie or it's a genre movie, I think that there are very few movies of 2017 that said things like Get Out was saying them. And mm-hmm. I think that that's going to get their attention. I would look to Jordan Peele to, at the very least, get a best screenplay nomination, best original screenplay for Get Out. I've got it on my best picture list right now. We'll see how it goes. Also, Blade Runner 2049, I'm not putting it on my best picture list, but I'm looking at it to get a ton of artistic and technical nominations. And I'm looking at it for like six or seven nominations right now. Without being in a single acting race or the screenplay race or the best director race or best picture. That's pretty notable. Roger Deakins, that's one of my picks this year. Roger Deakins is looking like maybe even the front runner for best cinematography.
I've heard it all before.
For Blade Runner 2049.
I've heard it all before.
He's heard it all before, too.
I can't be heartbroken again.
I'm pretty sure... I don't even know. I'll need to look up before the ceremony, if he does get the nomination, what this will make it. It's a lot of nominations. I mean, this dude's been nominated for everything. He's worked with the Coen brothers. I mean, he's worked with George Clooney. He's gotten just a ton of great nominations for some amazingly shot movies. It just might be his year. I think he has more nominations than any other person without winning.
Well, it's certainly one of those stories where you feel for the guy. And what a gorgeous movie, too. So...
And if there's a movie for him to win for, I think Blade Runner 2049 is probably it.
All right, Cameron. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up. Any final thoughts?
No, I'm excited to come on the show after the nominations have been announced, and we can talk more Oscar. I'm kind of right in the middle of my award season movie binge right now. So I'm in the process of trying to see everything. I'm going to try to see all the Best Picture nominees, by the time they're announced or shortly after they're announced. So that we can do a thorough breakdown of everything when the time comes.
All right. Well, Cameron, thanks for stopping by the cafe, and help yourself to another slice of pie, another cup of coffee, and we will
absolutely. Hey, can I get a refill over here? Can I get a refill for the road?
Careful. She's feisty tonight. All right. Well, Cameron, we'll catch up with you in another couple episodes. In the meantime, we're going to sign off because it's almost morning again.
Thanks, Trevor.